Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another week at the Damage Report with me, John Derulo, and also Brooke Thomas.
Hi. It is. It's Monday.
You are more colorful than usual. It's kind of like a holiday vibe,
is that
a little bit. Yeah.
Oh. Okay, bright, the tone. I was worried about the tone. You know, Hostmates was Friday, if you haven't seen it.
Uh-huh. Don't spoil it in case they haven't.
Our relationship is
which
it's up and down.
I know, but maybe the up is victory.
You never
won't know. Anyway, if you don't know what we're talking about, Hostmates is our yearly competition that we have at the TYT Network, where we pair up people from TYT to take a sort of that's the show that it's sort of mimicking.
It's like the Newlywed Game.
The Newlywed Game, but for people who host together, and we compete. And last year, we didn't do great.
We did great. We were entertaining, and I think
we
that
were entertaining.
When
yes,
work on a visual medium. That's most
That's
important.
More important.
Exactly.
We're clowns first, reporters second, basically. But anyway, the second one is now out. You can watch that if you're a member. If you're not a member, go to tyt.com/John. You can become a member.
Yeah.
So through the course of the show, we've got a lot that we're gonna be covering. In just a little bit, Michael Brooks, host of the appropriately named Michael Brooks Show, is gonna be joining us. We're breaking down some of the big news of the day with him. We've got the terrible Hanukkah attack. We've got Nabila Islam, candidate for Georgia's 7th District, who's been joining the show once again. And then a cop received a McDonald's cup with an attack against cops printed on it.
I hate these stories so bad. I hate them so much.
Well, we're going to delve into it, and we're going to see what's actually going on in America. But before we get to that,
they
which is a little bit fun,
other things to worry about.
No, this is it. This is what they have, which we'll describe. Okay, but we do have to start off on a more somber note. So we're going to be starting over here. Representative John Lewis, one of the longest serving congressmen, you know, an icon in DC, in Congress, announced some pretty sad news, apparently being diagnosed very recently with stage 4 pancreatic cancer, which is an extremely serious stage of cancer and an extremely serious stage of that cancer as well. He put out a press release, and we're gonna read just part of that. Representative John Lewis said, "I have been in some kind of fight for freedom, equality, basic human rights for nearly my entire life. I have never faced a fight quite like the one I have now. This month, in a routine medical visit and subsequent test, doctors discovered stage 4 pancreatic cancer. This diagnosis has been reconfirmed. While I am clear-eyed about the prognosis, doctors have told me that recent medical advances have made this type of cancer treatable in many cases, that treatment options are no longer as debilitating as they once were, and that I have a fighting chance." And all of that is true, but it is still a very serious form of cancer. And so a lot of people obviously, you know, they feel terrible for him and his family to face something like this. Just a dark day.
Yeah, but I am going with what his doctors are saying and what he's saying, and the fact that if anybody's a fighter, it's this man.
He's been fighting for a little while.
Yeah, so I'm like praying for him and his family, and you hope that he can beat this.
Exactly. He said further to his constituents, "Being your representative in Congress is the honor of a lifetime. I will return to Washington in coming days to continue our work and begin my treatment plan, which will occur over the next several weeks. I may miss a few votes during this period, but with God's grace, I'll be back on the front lines soon." You're allowed to miss a few votes.
Yeah.
Lots of people miss tons of votes without the stage 4 pancreatic cancer.
Exactly. Yeah. Some people show up and pretend and just don't do anything.
Exactly.
You know?
Feel free to take a few days off, honestly, at this point. Now, obviously, a lot of people, when this came out over the weekend, you know, they tweeted support for him. There were some great speeches and things like that. I'm just gonna note one. President Barack Obama tweeted, "If there's one thing I love about Representative John Lewis, it's his incomparable will to fight. I know he's got a lot more of that left in him. Praying for you, my friend." And it's got to be on the mind of literally everyone. Well, a lot of people across America, but definitely people in Congress, because on the Democratic side, I mean, he's long been considered one of like the, you know, the big moral figureheads of the Democratic Party for literally decades.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to give people, we can't go, you know, totally into his history and everything like that. And he's still very much, he's dealing with
a lot of history. Yeah.
There's a lot of history, but I just want to read just a little bit for people who might not be familiar with where he got his start and why he is such a big figure today. As a college student, he was a leader in the civil rights movement. He was one of the first freedom riders, activists who staged mobile protests on segregated buses across interstate lines. He participated in numerous sit-ins and worked to register black voters. For these and other civil rights efforts, he was beaten. His skull was cracked by a policeman during the historic Bloody Sunday March and jailed. His protests, including up until very recently, have led to him being arrested more than 40 times. And he's led, there was a gun control sit-in that he led last year, I believe it was. It was very recently, so he is maintaining that and has for literally decades now. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like he's, I think just more than almost anybody, he's like completely evolved with the times, like ready to take on what the new issue is and jump into it and be focused on it. And I just think he's great. And I think that we are not worthy. And I say that very often about Representative Lewis. But yeah, just like thinking about him and hope that he can beat this.
Yeah, and very recently, I mean, he was like, you can't say for sure, but hypothetically was very, very important in this impeachment push because he, I mean, it's just like less than 3 months ago now. He gave a speech. He was one of the holdouts for a long time. And he gave a speech. We covered it on the show. It was a powerful speech where what I liked about it was that he talked about impeachment the way I wish everyone did. That was about the Constitution, the obligation of the House to provide a check on the president when they get out of control. He talked about the substance of it, not just, oh, I don't know, 2020 might hurt us a little bit. And then like New York Times yesterday was like, will it embolden Trump? I talk about the substance. What was actually done, what the consequences for those crimes is supposed to be. And he did that because, you know, beyond almost anything else, he is an incredibly substantive man who understands the connection between our values and our politics, has for longer than we have been alive, almost together. Yeah, and so I appreciate that. And it definitely did seem to matter. I feel like that was sort of the thing that, you know, broke the dam.
I will always say this about Congressman Lewis and other members of like the CBC, but I think that recently they've, as far as like the presidential election, a lot of people have been upset with them for not supporting, I guess, what like the younger crowd's view of progress is. Mm-hmm. And not even not supporting it, just pushing for other people as well. And I think that one thing for me when it comes to this man, when it comes to Congressman Lewis, is that he has more experience. His perspective in life is so much more profound and so different than anything I can ever experience and I can ever imagine. He's been through much. He's fought for much more. Thankfully, I will never have the opportunity to fight for as much as he's fought for because fighting for that right, yes. It gives me the opportunity to be here.
We will be lucky if we do not have to fight that way.
I won't. It's just, you know,
and things are trending in a dark direction, but we'll see. Hopefully not.
But when someone like him says something, even if I don't immediately agree, I listen.
Yeah.
I want to hear his perspective.
And I feel that way about a few people. Yeah. Like there are people who I don't agree with on some fundamental things and I don't have to.
But I want to learn from, I'm like, listen, you obviously know something I don't. Mm-hmm. And we may end, but I want to hear what he has to say about everything.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't need to, like to respect a person, you don't have to agree with them on literally everything. And like when I saw this sort of news, it's always the event where it's like, I really hope that on social media, some people that I technically agree with more don't like there's this sort of self-destructive, pointless, contrarian need to like, oh, John Lewis voted some way I didn't like, so screw his decades and decades of activism.
But like when John Lewis, because of those decades, when John Lewis votes some way that you don't like, listen, you may still come away not agreeing.
Yeah.
But I think
don't
that we
write
should always
people off
come
if
at
you
it,
don't
right?
agree.
Like, well, why? Like you should always come at it like from somebody like this with like looking at the opportunity to understand or to learn.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. Okay, so we're gonna end it there. We're gonna take a short break. We come back. Michael Brooks is gonna be joining us once again on the show right after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Going back for some time, Andrew Yang has been supportive in his speeches and in his ads about Medicare for All. But now his healthcare plan is out, and it is not Medicare for All, which came up over the weekend in an interview that he had. Joining us now to break down this and other news, Michael Brooks, welcome back to the show.
Hey, pleasure to be here as always, John. How you doing?
We're doing good. Glad to have you here and here live for the first time, because normally our schedules don't sync up well with our broadcast times.
We were like, forget your vacation. Come to work.
Exactly.
How you doing, Brooke? Taking me right out of vacation. I love it.
Exactly. Okay, so I want to play a little section of Andrew Yang's recent appearance on, I believe it was a CBS. So we're going to play a little section of this back and forth and then comment after this.
I've looked at your healthcare plan. In fact, I've got it right here. And this plan does not call for Medicare for All. In fact, it doesn't even have a public option. So why the dissonance here?
We need to move towards universal healthcare that's high quality and nearly cost-free for Americans around the country. But reality is we have millions of Americans who are on private insurance right now, and taking those plans away from them very quickly would be untenable for many, many Americans. To me, the goal of the government has to be to demonstrate that we can outcompete private plans and then push them out of the market over time.
But that's what we're proposing.
But I'm
confused. Your ad is explicit. Your ad says Medicare for All. Your plan is not Medicare for All. It's not even Medicare for some, because in your plan, there's not even a public option.
Our plan is to expand a universal healthcare system to all Americans. Medicare for All is not the name of a bill. Medicare for All is universal healthcare for all Americans.
But Medicare for All is Medicare for All, right? I mean,
well, our healthcare plan would be based on Medicare and expanding it over time to more and more Americans. You lower the eligibility age and then you make it widely accessible.
Okay, I didn't see that in your plan.
So Michael, what did you make of that?
I think it would be less snappy, but he should replace his math pin with a disingenuity pin. I mean, look, I think that a lot of candidates have done their best to frankly obscure what is a pretty straightforward concept. It's an ambitious concept, but Medicare for All, there's no ambiguity about what that actually is. There's a bill in the Senate. Bernie Sanders has sponsored it. There's a version in the House.
Well, and let's just note that Medicare for All is in the name of the bill for Bernie Sanders.
Indeed.
Yes.
It is literally in the name of the bill, and it has been written. I think that this is a really big problem. I mean, I lay blame at all of the candidates, frankly, in varying ways for obscuring it. But I think that Andrew Yang's candidacy is interesting and a problem, because I think that in some ways he's definitely highlighting issues that are relevant to young people that have to do with deindustrialization. I think he totally oversells automation, though that's kind of another story. But the bigger picture of loss of jobs and the broader kind of social damage of that is valid and important. But really what he's putting on the table is, I mean, I'll try to be more diplomatic going into the new year, profoundly not comprehensive. He's basically talking about, you know, a cash payoff and then a couple of other, you know, like this healthcare proposal, sort of obscure industry friendly things. And now we go to the third pillar, where I don't know how else to say it. It seems to me he's being very dishonest. A couple of weeks ago, he was saying, you know, it's about the spirit of Medicare for All. Now it's just using that language. It's not Medicare for All. If you want to make that argument, make that argument.
Yeah, and I just want to be clear, because I know, like, if someone is watching this and they're a big supporter of Andrew Yang, they probably, like the supporters of several candidates, are frustrated with the lack of news coverage of what their candidates do. So I don't want you to think that I'm just like looking for things to criticize Andrew Yang about. I don't dislike Andrew Yang. He's been on the show, seems like a nice guy. But on this particular issue, this is something that we've been through before in this primary. When Elizabeth Warren appeared to be backing off Medicare for All, it was rightfully a big thing in the news. Pete Buttigieg, some of his past comments about Medicare for All that were very supportive, now he's not so much. That was a big thing, because this is one of the centerpieces of this primary. If we can't have an issue with someone appearing to strongly back off of that policy, then I don't know what we're doing in this primary.
Well, that's absolutely right. And let's be clear. I think all of the candidates, I think Warren with this sort of Rube Goldberg two-part thing has hurt Medicare for All. I think Pete Buttigieg has not only hurt Medicare for All with his flip-flop, he's now campaigning against it. But Andrew Yang, and again, this is a guy whose whole brand is as an outsider and as a truth teller, is actually being the most disingenuous of any of them about Medicare for All. And I would also say, you know, look, I think I've appreciated on other areas that Andrew Yang's been able to speak very clearly about some of the issues in terms of poverty and deindustrialization in this country. And then to really go to the most shallow talk about healthcare is ridiculous. I mean, we know that millions of people still don't have health insurance, and we know tens of millions in addition to them are basically uninsured because they can't use their health insurance, essentially, because it's still out of their price range. So they are, you know, I mean, the polite phrase is undercovered. Essentially, they're paying for a life-saving service that they can barely access. Yeah. This is a predatory, disgusting industry and practice that harms tens of millions of lives, prematurely costs people their lives, and bankrupts many others. We need to change it fundamentally. And if you don't want to, then, you know, make your defense of this barbarous system. Don't play around with clear language.
Yeah. I want there to be clear lines, and it seems like a lot of candidates have been trying to blend those two for a long time. And my last point on this is, if you are interested in learning more about the healthcare crisis, you should definitely take a look at, came out yesterday, Francesca Fiorentini's MSNBC special Red, White, and Who goes, it's all awesome. In on healthcare. Bernie Sanders makes an appearance. So if you're watching this, go take a look at that, and then tweet at MSNBC to have her do more episodes. But let's turn to another topic in the news today. Pete Buttigieg had some harsh words about Joe Biden on a topic that Joe Biden has not actually received much criticism on just yet. So this is what Pete Buttigieg said. This is an example of why years in Washington is not always the same thing as judgment. He supported the worst foreign policy decision made by the US in my lifetime, which was the decision to invade Iraq. And so I expected going into this primary that Biden's long support for the Iraq war would be a big detriment. It doesn't seem to have hurt him much yet. What do you think about Buttigieg choosing to make this a topic at this point in the primary?
I just have to say, totally tangent here. I'm noticing myself, this is a real vacation beard I have going. But regardless of that, I think that
it is. It looks like you just dropped out of the Democratic primary.
Yeah. Right, exactly. I think that, look, I think that it surprises me that we have not seen more from all of the candidates, though Bernie's done some on Iraq. Mm-hmm. I think that Buttigieg, though, is kind of a surprising person to bring it forward. I think his whole kind of foreign policy manifesto, he's criticizing it as a mistake, not as a systemic, moral, strategic failing. And I think that that's really a vital distinction. You know, if I was Biden, I would ask Buttigieg, what besides Iraq, theoretically, would you actually do differently from me? Mm-hmm. So, I think it's an interesting lane of attack. They're fighting for the same space. And I think Bernie's done it several times. I think it should be done more. Maybe it's the bigger lesson is that there are these major catastrophes that we're still living through that barely ever get any attention. Yeah. The Afghanistan war, the invasion of Iraq, and the 2008 financial meltdown, I think, are still the global template for our politics. And we barely talk about any of those things. Biden has a very bad record with regards to all three. Buttigieg gives zero indication. I mean, the youngest candidate with the oldest thinking in the race is Pete Buttigieg. And I have to say, If I was voting in that center right lane, I would pick Biden over Buttigieg, just as a tangent, because I think, look, people who are worried about beating Donald Trump, which you should be, and there's major concerns about Biden now against Trump, I just cannot comprehend, especially because so many people around Buttigieg talk about how serious they are. I cannot comprehend the level of lack of seriousness to even contemplate putting forward a college town mayor who can't win statewide in the Midwest with a bad record in a general election. It's actually embarrassing.
You know, one thing, so Pete's coming in now, he's bringing up Iraq. Maybe he'll do that in future debates and we'll see if it has an effect. But one thing that I don't know if you noticed it back before that I expected to happen was there was a sequence of three debates where Tulsi Gabbard was sort of targeting a candidate each time. And it seems like based on what she's running on, the core of her candidacy, attacking Biden for being supportive of these wars, like that seems like a slam dunk. But she didn't do that. And in fact, when asked about it, she was defensive of Joe Biden's record when she was, you know, attacking like Elizabeth Warren on foreign policy, which is fine. You can totally differentiate yourself there. But Elizabeth Warren didn't vote for the war in Iraq. That seems like that would have been a much stronger attack earlier in the race than Pete Buttigieg bringing it up now.
I think kind of my read in the beginning, I don't exactly know what Tulsi's strategy is now. I thought in the beginning that it seemed to me that even though she had this sort of break with the Democratic establishment, for lack of a better word, it seemed to me that she was definitely positioning herself for Biden's VP. I don't know now. I mean, she isn't on the stage anymore. But that would be the only rational explanation I could see for her not going after Biden on that stuff. And again, I just think it's really important to, you know, even Pete Buttigieg, frankly, it wasn't like this guy was an anti-war activist in college. It wasn't like this, you know, this opposition to the invasion of Iraq. You have to really watch when somebody talks about it as, you know, a blunder or a mistake versus what it really was, which was an illegal, horrifying, you know, absolutely unwarranted assault that has cost conservatively millions of lives, displaced many others, and wasn't just like, you know, it wasn't like running a stop sign or having a little too much to drink or something.
Exactly. Yeah, there were a number of bungles in it, but getting into it wasn't like, oops, we ended up in war. Right. Exactly. Okay, so I want to talk to you about one more thing a little bit quick, just because I've been noticing more about this. The New York Times recently had a profile of this Trump gathering, and they talked about a lot of different things. To be fair, people should look it up. But one thing they had was, what I have seen as a growing trend in interviews of Trump supporters is when the question gets to what if Trump loses in 2020, his supporters, or at least his most fervent supporters, seem very comfortable implying that they're going to pick up their guns and start shooting people. Which if I were going to do that, I would probably hold my cards closer to my chest. But they're putting them out there for everyone to see. And in this most recent article, Mark Villalta says he's been stockpiling firearms in case Trump doesn't win. He says nothing less than a civil war would happen. I don't believe in violence, but I'll do what I got to do. I would argue you believe in violence, Mr. Villalta. But what do you think about these Trump supporters claiming that they're going to start shooting if he loses?
I mean, obviously it's a huge problem. And it's of course connected with some of the, you know, increase of basically right-wing terrorism. I really have a problem with the overuse of that word, but some of these events could certainly be described in those terms. However, I really think though, when you look, of course there's a reciprocal relationship between what Trump stokes in this country and the kind of rhetoric you see in that article. But I think that it's very important to disaggregate between, you know, again, people who might be alienated, people who might in some cases be enormously destructive and a problem, you know, in terms of electorally and what they represent socially in this country. But I think you have to again go to the top and you have to look at what Bill Barr thinks about this country as an example. What the Republican Party as a decades-long project. And I always try to disaggregate these things. I'm obviously somebody who thinks that there is a capital class that envelops both parties that has, you know, generated obscene inequality and is hurtling us into it. We're in an ecological crisis. And I think it totally transcends partisan politics and it's a question of economics and many other things. However, in the Republican Party specifically, I go back to this really good book called Democracy in Chains by Nancy McLean, that there are a lot of people from the donor networks to the judicial system in the Republican Party that they've been stuffing the courts, of people who really don't believe in democracy as we would normally define it, and they want to greatly narrow it. And so that's why you can't separate this from the assaults on the Voting Rights Act and civil rights, the rhetoric that you get fed from the top. But then also we got to be real. I mean, you know, the other problem here, and I don't care, I'm not even talking about hypocrisy. I'm talking it's performative contradiction for Democrats to come out and say rightly that this administration represents a threat to democracy and then re-up the Patriot Act and give these guys a completely unaccountable military budget. I think these things are very concerning. I think if you look at scenarios where societies really deteriorate, whether it's like in the Balkans or Indonesia or Burundi or whatever, right-wing paramilitaries, gang forces are kind of subcontracted these roles by authoritarian governments. So I see some seeds of that in articles like that. But I still think like I'm going to get less aggravated and worried necessarily by some idiots in a newspaper article, offense. Versus, what is actually coming from the top of this administration. That is a much more durable concern.
Okay, I think we can agree there. Everybody, definitely go check out the Michael Brooks Show. Michael, as always, we love having you on.
Yeah, you guys are great. Happy holidays. I'm going to go back to my vacation. Thanks,
okay.
guys.
Okay, go take a nice nap. I'll see you soon.
Exactly.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here. We come back, lots more to get to. Over the weekend, there was another horrific attack. We're talking now about the stabbings during a Hanukkah celebration. Of course, there were other attacks over the weekend as well, including a shooting at a church, I believe in Texas. But I want to give you details about this attack because there have actually been some developments over the last 24 hours. A man entered Orthodox Rabbi Rottenberg's house in Monsey, New York during a Hanukkah celebration, stabbed and wounded five people, then fled in a vehicle. The victims of the attack, which is about 35 miles from New York City, were all Hasidic Jews. The town has a large Hasidic Jewish population. And I've been, like a lot of people, I've been trying to get as much information about this as possible. And I came across an interview with one of the survivors of the attack. And what he had to say about the experience was truly amazing. So here's a section of what he had to say.
I was sitting in the rabbi's dining room just when the rabbi finished the candle lighting ceremony, when the attacker came in. He first stood in the entry room. He started hitting people right and left with his big machete knife. I don't know what it was. And then that's when I started to run out through a side door together with all the people in the dining room. We ran out through the back of the house, through the back of the door, the back door outside. I ran back to the front door to see if I could help anyone from the other side. That's when I came back in, the elder guy who had the brain fracture was still standing there bleeding. And I asked him, "Let's go, come out. The guy's still in the kitchen. The attacker's still in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. Let's go out." He said, "I can't. I'm bleeding. I can't." That's when I saw him coming back towards me. I ran out, and I saw that he went to the old guy. I came back in, grabbed the coffee table that was on the floor, hit him in his face. And that's when he came back outside after me. He told me, "Hey, you, I'll get you." Mm. And he started walking towards me, and I was running. I was going before him like a few feet, screaming, "He's coming, he's coming." Everybody in the synagogue should run away. Mm. He went almost to the door of the synagogue. He reached for the door, it was locked. He went to the next door, it was locked too. Mm. That's when he walked down a side street towards his car. I didn't know where he was walking to, but I walked with him slowly. He sat into his car, I looked for his plate number, called 911. Wow. And I came back up the street, the police officers were already there.
Wow, so that was Joseph Gluck, one of the survivors of the stabbing. And I mean, possibly as a result of shock. What he's describing in a very level-headed, calm fashion. But that's like unimaginably horrific, the experience that he had.
It's horrible.
He was able to do in it.
Yeah, he's gonna have to like live with that for the rest of his life. It's horrible. It's horrifying and so sad listening to him. kind of recount that. And it's horrible. I think that it is so unfair that, you know, like a group of people are now rightfully afraid of being in their place of worship, of going, of being there. There is a little bit of fear because of things that have happened, because of rhetoric that's constantly being pushed from, you know, our highest office. And also now, like, there's, like, you would have a fear of being at your faith leader's home, mm-hmm. you know, for a holiday celebration.
For the holidays.
Yeah, it's awful. It's unfair.
Yeah. Look, he says, what he describes there is like going back in to help people. You'd gotten away from a guy who's running around with a machete. You go back in, tries to get people out, attacks the guy with the machete, buying some time, then tries to get as many other people out as possible. I mean, it's amazing. God only knows if he had not done what he did, perhaps that the older man that he tried to help might have died. He might have been attacked again. Other people potentially too. But he says, I don't feel like a hero. I feel God is a hero. He sent me in the right place in the right time, and he gave me the right state of mind. I mean, he did what everybody would like to think that they would do in this situation. But I agree with you. I mean, this is both horrific, but also one of the things that makes it so horrific is because it is a pattern of attacks like this against the Jewish community. Just a few weeks ago, there was a shooting. I believe it was in New York as well, perhaps New Jersey. Synagogues have been attacked multiple times recently. It's becoming almost routine that in any given month, there's going to be some crazed person, and they have a suspect. I'm not gonna give details about them because I don't care about that individual, but they have a suspect that they believe is the person who did it, who just targets the Jewish community. And there are other, I mean, we mentioned, you know, a church was attacked as well. There's a lot of violence in America to go around, but in particular, attacks against Jewish communities, religious centers, those sorts of things have become horrifically common.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it was horrible, and this is why people are so, and not sensitive, that's not the word I want to use, but so rightfully like speaking out against some of the rhetoric, because yeah. it's a slope to this.
Yeah,
you know, it brings violence and like feeds hatred that is unnecessary.
Exactly. Okay, we're gonna take a short break, but stick around. Political candidates across the country who are pushing for a major structural change to the way healthcare and health insurance is dealt with in the United States received a bit of a boost to what they've been saying with a New York Times report comparing the cost of different medical procedures and tests between the United States and other parts of the world. As an example of some of these, we turn to a tweet from Bernie Sanders that says, an MRI scan costs over $1,400 in America. It's just $450 in the UK. An angioplasty costs $32,000 in America. In the Netherlands, it's $6,400. And he concludes by saying, other major countries cover all their people and pay half of what we do. Don't tell me we can't afford Medicare for all. And while Bernie Sanders is one of the presidential candidates that's pushing for a big change to healthcare in America, there are other candidates that are calling for similar changes. And we are joined by one now, joining us once again on the Damage Report, Nabila Islam, congressional candidate for Georgia's 7th district, joins us now.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Glad to have you back. So what did you make of this report? I mean, I guess it's not too shocking to find out that the costs are much higher in the United States, but some of these disparities are difficult to understand.
Oh, it's definitely egregious. Look, we're the richest country in the world, and yet we also have the richest, we pay the most for our healthcare system. And most people in our country, a lot of people in our country aren't covered, and it's indicative of a broken healthcare system. And that's why in my district, you know, there's 135,000 people in my district that don't have healthcare. I myself don't have healthcare, and that's why I support a single payer Medicare for all.
You know, in the report, they talked about how you have some candidates that are calling for Medicare for all, some calling for the elimination of private health insurance companies. But even those with more centrist plans that are not calling for getting rid of these companies, they are now all pushing for cost controls in a way that we haven't necessarily seen coming from the center in past cycles. What do you think about that tactic? Is that going to be enough in presidential races, congressional races, when the severity of the problem just, it seems so bad?
Look, we need a single-payer healthcare system. We can't afford a compromise with private insurance companies, because if we do that, we're going to leave people behind. We're not going to be able to cover everyone in this country. And so we need to strongly advocate for Medicare for all and make sure that everyone in this country has health care.
So as you're campaigning, I know that, you know, like Medicare for all in some polls very popular. There are people though that are concerned that in some sorts of districts that might be divisive. As you're talking to your potential constituents, what do they think about switching over to something like Medicare for all?
Oh, they are very, they want Medicare for all. They understand that what these private insurance companies are doing to them are price gouging them. The fact that, look, only sick people make a profit off of sick people, and they're tired of the hassle of that they have to put up with private insurance companies. And they definitely have been communicating with me that they want Medicare for all.
You know, since you last joined us, Nabila, there's been a little bit more time to campaign, and I saw that you got a pretty interesting endorsement from Occupy Democrats. Apparently, the first ever endorsement from the group for a primary candidate. So, what did you think about getting that endorsement?
Well, we were super excited to get their endorsement. As you mentioned, I'm the first candidate in the primary to get that endorsement. And they have said that they're going to put their full weight behind our candidacy, my campaign. And I'm excited to work with them to make sure that everyone in our district they learn about the progressive values that we've been campaigning on.
And you know, we noticed one thing that you had tweeted recently that certainly stood out. If we could bring that up, you tweeted electability is a myth. I believe that's 11 times. So when I tweet things like that, there's usually something specific on my mind. So tell me, what were you getting at with that tweet?
Well, electability is a myth because for so long we've been socially conditioned into thinking that typically it's pale, stale, and often male. Are folks that are the most electable, especially in the South. But that's truly changed. After we saw 2018 happen, we elected some of the most diverse candidates to Congress ever, more women more than ever. And it has shown that, you know, people from different faiths, different cultures are electable. And not only that, that if you can run on progressive values and be electable all over the country.
You know, it's interesting because at a different level, at the presidential level, one thing that I've noticed, and I have to admit my bias, I endorse Bernie Sanders, but when you ask people who support Joe Biden, who is currently leading the race, he's been leading for many months, what makes them support him, a large percentage say because they believe that he can beat Donald Trump. When the media covers Joe Biden, they say, well, he's the most electable. So then people watching hear that he's the most electable and then say that they will support him because he's the most electable. So he's in first, which is why the media says it. It's this interesting cyclical thing. And so what I'm wondering, when you talk about electability being a myth, there's a media component to it. There's a, you know, DNC, DCCC component to it. To what extent do you think that the media is responsible for shaping the sorts of candidates that people think can win in different parts of the country, including your district?
Oh, I definitely think the media has a hand in it. It is a vicious cycle. People keep saying that Joe Biden, he's familiar, he's the candidate that everyone will vote for, that can beat Donald Trump. I don't think that's true. I mean, we need candidates that truly see the electorate at large. Candidates like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have been communicating with, you know, diverse minorities all over the country. And I feel like I've seen more and more of these communities come out for these candidates, and including my district as well. When I first started to campaign, a lot of people told me that, you know, no one's going to vote for you or you shouldn't run for office. But I think it's important to, you know, run for office and make sure that we have more diverse candidates who are talking about progressive policies that are going to effectuate real change in their communities. And I have found that since I've started this campaign, a lot of people have been inspired, and it is hard to break through the media. And it's important that we just keep speaking up and pushing.
No, one other small change, at least to your current election, is that one of the Republicans who had been running dropped out to run in the 6th district and cited the position of one of the candidates in that race on impeachment, being in favor of impeachment, saying that that's not representative. There's been a lot of concern from the media that, and from, you know, the heads of the Democratic Party, that the position on impeachment that a candidate has could be affecting their chance of getting elected. Have you noticed in your race, has impeachment been a big part of what people have been talking to you in town halls and when you're campaigning? Does it seem to be affecting your race much?
Of course. Look, I think people elected, we won the majority last year because we wanted to hold Donald Trump accountable. Nobody likes Donald Trump, especially in my district. And they have talked about impeachment and how they want him impeached and removed from office. And so it's been a big issue because they want to see that we are holding him accountable. And they have supported me in when I first came out for impeachment way back in May. And so it's been a big issue on the campaign trail.
Okay. And Nabila, where can people find out more about your candidacy?
They can go to NabilaForCongress.com. We have less than 48 hours before we hit our end of quarter deadline. So if anyone would like to make a small contribution, you can do so at NabilaForCongress.com, or you can check me out on Twitter at NabilaForGeorgia7 or on Instagram as well.
Nabila Islam, a candidate in 7th District of Georgia. Thank you once again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me again. Take care.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, McDonald's was the site of a bit of a dust up with the police. But what's the actual truth behind it? We'll break that down after this. About every month or so, someone scrawls something offensive on a coffee cup and it becomes a big scandal. But it doesn't always turn out to be what it seems at first. So we've got an example of that. Take a look at headlines like this have been all over the place. Junction City McDonald's investigating effing pig written on cop's coffee.
This is
all we know so far.
Okay.
Is that supposedly this happened and you don't like it?
No, I just think these are so stupid. Like calling a police officer a pig is not a hate crime. It's not a racial slur. Okay, like we have to stop acting like it. Like, okay, some people don't like police officers. Mm-hmm. More people should not like bad police officers, mm-hmm. including good police officers. But that's a whole other thing that they're not as quick to talk about and give statements about like they are when somebody calls them an animal that oinks.
Yes, and by the way,
These are so stupid.
I feel like I should remind people, animals are innocent. Leave animals out of it.
But like
in terms
somebody
of
dies and we get nothing. Mm-hmm. We get nothing. We get a police officer who keeps their job at least temporarily. We get these kind of like, and we're surprised when we don't get a lackluster kind of like response from the chief.
That's true.
But when an officer, God forbid, gets the word pig written on their cup of coffee, it is mm-hmm. national news. The chief comes in and is like, oh my goodness, these people who make like minimum wage need to be punished.
Yeah.
This cannot happen. We have like this Fortune 500 company CEO that's like, we do not stand for this. This is mm-hmm. not okay. And none of it's okay, but I just hate that like it is this. We get
it's bigger
the
news
biggest,
always.
Quickest reaction from a police department when something stupid like this happens. When somebody calls a police officer a name on their coffee.
I agree. In the future, we live in such a weird country that like if a cop abuses you in some way, the only way you can reliably get news coverage of it is if you were to write about it on a coffee cup.
Right, exactly.
Honestly, and then give it to the cop who abused you. But I will say this, Brooke. If you are frustrated with a story of someone insulting a cop on a coffee cup, I can only imagine how frustrated you will be when you find out that they didn't.
Right. I feel like there's always the story always sort of kind of leans this way.
Exactly. Well, let me run through the facts because we're low on time.
Okay.
So blah blah blah, it happened to this cop. then apparently was offered a free lunch, but it's McDonald's, so that's not that much money, honestly.
But it's worth it. It's fine. It's good.
Exactly. And so let's see. We have the manager who wrote, "My McDonald's have the utmost respect for all members of law enforcement and the military, and we're troubled by the accusation made. We thoroughly reviewed our security video from every angle, which clearly shows the words were not written by one of our employees. We look forward to working with Chief Hornaday as he continues his investigation." The thing is, Hornaday apparently spent a day at McDonald's looking at the security tape, but couldn't find any evidence. But it took the manager saying that it hadn't happened for that to be an update to the story. So the immediate follow-up question has to be, well, then who wrote it? And I suspect that we all know. I'm not saying anything because I don't know. It is possible that a pig wrote it. It's possible that it just came that way from the factory, I guess.
That's gonna be it.
But if the video shows that an employee didn't write it, maybe it was that bird.
But like, I feel like you're implying that a police officer would lie.
I didn't imply anything.
Because that is
I didn't imply anything.
That has never been proven to happen.
I'm only saying two things. One, if you work in a service job, like I've worked in almost every service job imaginable, don't write things like that on cups. but also to everybody in America, stop making up things on cups.
And do you know
because
what?
That is becoming too common.
I said this Friday, and I feel very strongly about it. The customer is never right.
Mm-hmm.
Never.
That's a big shift.
The customer is never right. Okay, uh-huh. Most likely. Okay,
what about when you're the customer?
If I'm acting a fool, I'm wrong.
Okay,
the customer is never right.
I'm gonna bear that in mind. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, that's unfortunately all the time we have.
Yeah.
But it was great to have you here as always.
It's always great.
Always,
to be
maybe
here.
In the future we'll have even more of you.
Yes.
You know, a second hour where we just chit chat. We'll
we
see.
We would love that.
We'll
yes.
see. Okay, thank you everybody for joining us. We will be back tomorrow with a lot more. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.